Welcome to Paradise in the Pines, a podcast about the people, places, and stories that make this the home of American golf. Brought to you by the Pinehurst Southern Pines Aberdeen Area Convention and Visitors Bureau. Hello again, everybody, and welcome back to Paradise in the Pines. I'm Phil Wurz, the President and CEO of the Pinehurst Southern Pines Aberdeen Area Convention and Visitors Bureau. We're joined, and we're honored today to be joined by a local star. To be honest with you, Mitch Cable, award-winning storyteller, writer, artist, author, actor, and poet, and native of Southern Pines. So, Mitch, great, and your busy schedule and what you got going on. Thank you for taking time to enter Paradise in the Pines with us.
Thanks for inviting me, Phil. Appreciate being here.
Yeah, man. I got to tell you, I mean, the list of accolades, I mean, I could sit here and read these. We'd be here for the entire podcast. It's unbelievable what you have done in your career. It's been amazing. I mean, you grew up in Southern Pines, and your grandmother, Elnora Leake Chapel, read the book, The Life and Works of Paul Laurence Dunbar.
Yes.
I remember my mom reading me some books, but this book in particular really struck a chord with you, and it's been your life's work. Why is that?
Well, because she read that particular poem called A Cabin Tale about a weasel and a bear to me. It just resonated. When I finished college, I started working with my father in the cookware business. Mm. And he would tell me stories from Windblow, from Derby, from over there off the creek, he called it. And he said, man, if you love this creek talk, you love this. And I just loved the stories he was telling me about from over there. And he handed me that old worn-out book, and I meant to brought it with me to show you. It didn't have a cover to it. It was just pages missing.
You still have it today?
Oh, yeah. I still have it. And that was the source of entertainment for my ancestors, for my grandmother, for her father and mother. This is what they used. There was no TV. There was no radio back then, and they read from this book. And so when my father and mother would go to conventions on the weekends and what have you, we would stay with alternate grandparents. But when we stayed with Elnora Leake Capel, my father's mother, she would pull out that book and read the Cabin Tale from Paul Laurence Dunbar's Life and Works of Paul Laurence Dunbar. And the fact that she could read, number one. Mm. Number two, that she could read the dialect, number two. And the way that it just tickled her to death to be able to read that to us. And,
yeah.
And so it just, when I finished college, my father handed me that book and I read it. And I was like, oh, man, I remember this story. My grandmother read it to me. So I started reading it to my kids. They went here every night. I memorized it. Told a friend one day, he said, man, I'm head of the entertainment committee for this banquet. I can't find anybody. Would you come and tell that story? I'm going, me? He said, yes, I did. They were teachers in the audience. And it just sort of snowballed from there. I created the character. My goal was to memorize all of Paul Dunbar's work. And I created the character because of the dialect and the times he was talking about it. And I used to actually gray my beard. I'd be in the bathroom putting with toothbrushes and some white shoe polish. Mixing it together and putting it on my beard, and men would come in and go, man, we always take it out. We never put it in.
It reminds me, when I was a kid, I would take my dad's Grecian Formula 16 and put it on my peach fuzz so to make it darker. Now I want to make it light. Right. Now in the opposite way. But but it's awesome. It's amazing, too, when you think about today and everybody scrolling, TikTok and all that. I mean, have this generation missed, do you think, the opportunity to read and to take on books, things like that? And how does that make you feel?
I think it has, even though you can read the books on your tablets and what have you, but it's just different than actually holding a book in your hand and turning the page. And this particular book was the most well-loved book I'd ever seen in my life because the pages were missing. You know, it was just, I could feel my ancestors holding it. I could, you know, just the part of it. But I think it's important that we do continue to have books and write books and have the hard copies of the books and be able to do it that way as opposed to being on a tablet.
This particular book with Dunbar, I mean, many kids don't even realize what they're going to do for their career until they're in their 20s. I mean, but why did it strike such a chord with you that you made it your life's work?
Because when I read that story, and when I got a hold of the book, first of all, that story grabbed me. And then when I'm reading the other poetry and I read about Paul Dunbar's life, that's what grabbed me. The fact that his parents came from enslaved, they were enslaved, and his mother being on the plantation in Kentucky and teaching herself to read and write by making cakes and cookies and pies during the day and trading slices and cookies with kids coming home from school to learn the ABCs for them to teach her the ABCs and teach herself to read and write.
Yeah.
And then teach Paul to read and write, and was adamant about the fact that he got a good education. So he was the only African-American in school with the Wright brothers who graduated in 1891, way before we even thought about integration or anything like that. And the fact that the stories that he is telling in this book came directly from his mother and father and people in the community. So it's not a washed down version of history. It's actually from the people who actually lived through it. And he just happened to put these stories in a poetic verse, and they were just so powerful. And I was like, I don't think this should be lost. And Paul Dunbar, before schools were integrated, was part of the curriculum. You had to learn some Dunbar and stand up and recite Dunbar, and you had to recite Langston Hughes. You had to recite all these different poets. So I didn't want that to be lost as well. So that was my purpose, to try to keep his story alive.
We won't get into school boards and the books you're having kids read these days. It's it can be a little controversial, as you know. Yeah, it's kind of crazy. But again, you've turned this into a career. And when you look at the accolade, did you ever think that, you know, just being a poet laureate or learning Dunbar would take you to all the places around the world? How fortunate do you feel like you've been to have the career that you've had?
Never dreamed of it in a million years. I never thought of public speaking in my life. I know when I started working for my dad's cookware business, I would watch my father stand up in front of sales meetings and actually just wow everybody. And I was just amazed at how he could get up and do that. Then it forced me to get up because he made me a sales manager. So I had to get up and start talking as well. And I remember being very nervous about it. But learning Paul Dunbar. So once I received that book, I studied that book. I carried that book with me for 7 years. Just anybody that would listen, that anybody I could read to, anybody, I would say, "Let's check this out." And then I was memorizing every summer. I would just memorize. If it talked to me, I knew it would talk to you. Mm-hmm. So I started memorizing all of this work. And it just, like I said, it just snowballed. I found out there were organizations, storytelling festivals in Jonesboro, Tennessee, the Black Storytelling Festival. And I'm like, wow. So I ran into a guy, Madafo, who became my mentor. He just passed away, out of Wilmington, North Carolina, and he was in Fayetteville, and I stopped. He was at the library, and he stopped and told me after his show exactly what to do. He said, "You need to go to a storytelling festival. You need to meet Brother Blue."
Yeah,
and that was the best advice he could give me, because Brother Blue was, oh my God, he was on it. I thought I was storytelling, but he just took it to another level. So
I read in some of the research for this, you've performed at Foo Foo Festival, other festivals, storytelling. Is that a lost art, or is it becoming a lost art?
It's making a resurgence. The one in Jonesboro, Tennessee, that festival's been going on, gosh, now probably 40 years. And the first weekend in October, you'll have 35,000 people come in. And I've always wanted to try to do something like that here in Southern Pines, to do a storytelling festival and bring friends in. And it's great for the economy, it's great for the town. And the other storytelling festival I do, the National Association of Black Storytellers, it's a traveling festival. It goes to different cities every year. So we'll be in Buffalo next year. We were in Utah last year, Salt Lake City, Utah. So it's a traveling festival. But I think it's just been fabulous, man. I tell you, it's been wonderful. Meeting great people and other storytellers and watching people work, it's fun.
You've performed the Kennedy Center, United Nations.
Yes.
I mean, what has been the most memorable? I mean, the list, I said, is long, but I mean, what has been the most memorable experience being able to share your story?
Well, the most memorable for me has to be when President Obama was elected. I was going to the inauguration, and I got a call from a guy who said, my name is, last name Robinson, and we want to bring you in to perform for the inauguration of President Obama. I hung up on him. I thought it was a prank call. So he called back and said, no, don't hang up. Don't hang up. This is real. And I'm like, no, man, come on, for real.
Yeah.
So leading up to the inauguration, I was there performing at the Smithsonian Castle for 2 days.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And I'm in there, and I'm looking at all the athletes, and I'm looking at the movie stars, and I'm looking at all these people watching me perform.
Yeah.
And that had to be pretty much the highlight, because it's such a historical.
Does that make you nervous?
No, it doesn't. I mean, the thing about it is,
it gets you jacked, huh?
The thing about it is, I know my material so much.
Yeah.
I study, and when, like around Christmas time, I have Christmas stories, and you know, I don't get to do them every year, so sometimes people invite me, and I have to. So when I'm driving, I'm trying to recharge my computer up here and make sure I still know them. If I don't, then I have to go back and look at them again. So, no, I'm not nervous, because I know my material. I mean, you know, I'm not saying it to be bragging or anything, but
well, how many times have you told it?
Exactly. I mean, and I tell it to myself sometimes. You know, when I can't go to sleep, I'm running stories through my head. You know,
if you can indulge us and give us a version of a quick story.
Okay, so this is a story I always finish with. It's by Paul Laurence Dunbar, and it's called The Seedling, and it goes like this. Just happened to bring a napkin. As a quiet little seedling lay with in its darksome bed. To itself it fell a talking, and this is what it said: I am not so very robust, but I'll do the best I can. And that seedling, from that moment, its work of life began. So it pushed a little leaflet up into the light of day to examine the surroundings and show the rest the way. The leaflet liked the prospect, so it called its brother, Stem, and two other leaflets heard it and quickly followed them. To be sure, the haste and hurry made the little seedling pant, but almost before it knew it, it found itself a plant. The sunshine poured upon it, and the clouds, they gave a shower, and that little plant kept growing till it found itself a flower. Folks, be like the little seedlings. Always do the best you can. Everyone must share life's labors, be you child, woman, or man. And the sun and rain will help you through life's lonesome struggling hours to raise to light and beauty virtue's fair, unfading flowers.
Beautiful.
Give it to you.
Thanks, Mitch.
You're welcome.
Fantastic. Talk about Granddaddy Junebug.
Okay.
What is Granddaddy, or who is Granddaddy Junebug?
So Granddaddy Junebug is a character I created when I started memorizing Paul Dunbar's work because of the dialect. It's speaking in them and they and those, and speaking of things in the past from a different era, from the late 1900s. Late 1800s, early 1900s. So I felt an older person should be telling this story, not a 30-year-old guy like me. Hmm. So I created a character. I was working for a company, Piedmont Airlines, who wouldn't allow me to grow a beard. So I flew to LA and I bought me a fake beard. Had this fake beard on, and I would glue it on my face every time. And put a little piece of licorice in my mouth and talk like that. So I just, what I wanted was, young people, after they heard me telling stories, was to go home and ask their grandparents for stories and songs and for games that they knew as children. Mm. So that was it. So Granddaddy was the name that I picked up. Junebug was a character, John O'Neill, God rest his soul, Junebug Jabbo Jones. I saw him perform here at the Sunrise Theater. And I called him and I said, John, I'm thinking of calling myself Junebug. And he said, oh, yeah, you know how Junebug worked, because he talked about how Junebug was, Junebug Jabbo Jones, it was a lot of them back on the plantations, and all of them were going around telling stories. And somebody said, I saw Junebug over here. And he was like, no, I saw Junebug over here last night. So they thought he was working some magic.
Right.
So he's like, no. So I said, I started calling myself Granddaddy Junebug. And what gave me the idea was, I was calling myself Granddaddy, and I was calling the little boys Junebugs and little girls Jelly Beans when I would do storytelling. And this little boy one day said, hey, if we're Junebugs and they're Jelly Beans, you're Granddaddy, you must be the Granddaddy Junebug. And I said, let me call John and make sure this is going to be cool. Yeah.
Can you give us a little in character?
Want a story? Just hear that. Where you think I get a story at? Didn't I tell you three last night? Go away chilling. Y'all ain't right. I got something else to do besides just telling tales to you. Tell you just one? Well, let me see. What that one are going to be? When you's old, your memory fail. Seem like I don't know no tale. Well, sit down there in that chair and keep still if you wants to hear. And take that chin up off them hands and set up nice. Now, goodness land. Hold yourself up like your ma and pa. Bet nobody ever saw them all scrunched down like y'all was then. High tone girls and boys makes high tone women's and men's.
Fantastic. That's awesome.
That is actually the introduction to, that's the lead into the cabin tale that my grandmother used to tell. And then she would start telling that story. So
we're here with Mitch Capel, award-winning storyteller, writer, artist, author, actor, and poet from Southern Pines. You're going to be performing as we record this just a couple days before your appearance at the Weymouth Center for the Arts and Humanities, very near and dear to the CVB here, and Katie does a great job there. You're going to be appearing there on Sunday, February the 25th at 2 o'clock. Tickets are free, but you need to register because tickets are limited.
Right.
You need to see Mitch. So talk about what you're going to do on the 25th.
So the 25th, I've invited two other storytellers to be with me. Willa Brigham out of Cary, North Carolina. She had an award-winning children's show on TV. She's won Emmys a couple times. She's going to be there, as well as a mother mentor out of Charlotte, North Carolina, two storytellers that I've had the pleasure of sharing the stage with over the years. They're absolutely wonderful. So we'll be sharing, I understand the first performance at 2 o'clock is sold out, but we're scheduling another one at 5 o'clock. So you need to register if you want to go, because limited seating, there's only 70 seats. So we want to make sure that everybody has a chance to be there.
But awesome.
We're going to have fun, though. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Awesome. It's February 25th, 2 o'clock at the Weymouth Center. I'm sure if you just went to the Weymouth Center website, you'd be able to find that.
Yes.
You grew up, we mentioned you grew up in Southern Pines. What was it like growing up in Southern Pines? We know what it's like today, and it's come a long way in that time. What was it like growing up here?
Southern Pines was wonderful. In my early years, I was born in 1955, so I ended up I went to kindergarten at West Southern Pines School and first grade, and then the Catholic school opened up, which is now the Coalition and the Douglas Center.
Yeah.
The Douglas Center was actually the school. The Coalition was actually the priest and the nuns where they stayed. But I went there until, I think, the fourth grade, and then the Catholic school, St. Anthony's, integrated before the public schools did. So my parents thought it'd be best to go to a integrated school, and which was great because the nuns actually taught us there. I learned English. I mean, they were fabulous. It was small classrooms and what have you. And I learned also at Lady Victory and over at West Southern Pines School as well. And then once the schools integrated, I went to East Southern Pines, which is now the Montessori School, I think 7th grade and 8th grade. And then by then, Pinecrest High School had opened up. So I was a freshman when Pinecrest opened. But it was fabulous. I mean, I grew up with great people. Everyone I met, all my classmates from every school I've been in, we're still in contact today with most of them, and it's just a wonderful environment. I mean, I remember when things were segregated, things here were different. I remember my father and Voight Gilmore actually integrated Southern Pines. I remember when that happened. I remember how they did it, and I remember going to the Sunrise Theater and having to go into the back and walk up, pay your money, and go up the steps and sit in the balcony. I remember doing that. Overall, Southern Pines has been a wonderful, wonderful city. It's growing by leaps and bounds. Mm-hmm. You know, I drive around now and look at the areas that used to be woods and now they're,
right.
It's no longer woods.
Yeah.
But, you know, growth is imminent. And I think it's, I think our town planners are doing a great job with what we're doing here. So, people come here and they just fall in love with it. I remember in 1999 when the U.S. Open was here, people came and they said, hey, just send somebody to get our stuff. We're not leaving. We're staying here.
it still goes on today.
It still goes on today.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's an amazing, magical, special place.
Special place. It is.
You mentioned the town planners, and I know in Southern Pines here with Reagan Parsons, B.J. Grieve, there's been discussions in West Southern Pines. I've only been here 6 years, but I mean, there's a tremendous Black cultural heritage of that part of town,
yes.
To the point where there's discussion of a Black cultural heritage center. And I forget the gentleman's names who I spoke with, this is before the pandemic, about, that's part of tourism. That's a story that needs to be told.
Yes.
And is very much a part of the fabric of this community.
Yes.
Talk about how that's coming along. Are you familiar with that endeavor?
Absolutely.
And what's happening?
You probably talked to Vince Gordon.
That's exactly who I spoke with.
Yeah, yep. Vince was over that and still is. Southern Pines Housing Land Trust. They are right now working on the museum part of it. They brought in Bob Smith out of Detroit, who's going to be putting together the museum. He's been interviewing people all in West Southern Pines, collecting artifacts. They're going to have an antiques roadshow where people can bring their stuff in.
Wow, that's cool.
And then they're going to use it if they lend it to them or give it to them or if they have to buy it or whatever for the museum. He's offered to stay on until the completion of the museum. We're looking 2 years out, and it's going to be all of Moore County, not just West Southern Pines.
Okay.
They're going to include everybody. They're talking about the bringing. Well, one thing is my father. Bob is really keyed in on my dad and the accomplishments he's made here in West Southern Pines and Southern Pines, and also the caddies, the jockeys. You know, people like that, that unsung heroes from West Southern Pines. But I remember my dad telling me back in the day that we had our own brick masons, carpenters, electricians, plumbers. He was proud of the fact that everybody that worked on our house that we lived in New Hampshire Avenue, that everybody was right there in West Southern Pines.
Yeah.
They did all the work, and that was pretty proud. But nowadays, we don't have that anymore. So,
other than yourself, who are some of the people that we might learn about with this Black Cultural Heritage Center in West Southern Pines that are from here, people may not realize they made huge contributions?
Well, there's you know, as far as golfers go, as far as caddies, you had Willie McRae,
mm-hmm. one yeah, absolutely.
Great character. Hard Rock Robinson, another caddy, pardon me, from that era. You had Jug Douglas, who the Douglas Center is named after, who was a mayor of Southern Pines, the first black mayor. My dad was the first black mayor pro tem, and he was on the city council. I think he served about 12 years, mm-hmm. treasurer, what have you. A lot of people. Pudgy Pugh, who was a businessman in West Southern Pines. He ran the Pugh's Funeral Home and other enterprises. My Uncle Chester Goins owned the nightclub over there in West Southern Pines. There were stores all in West Southern Pines. There were doctors over in West Southern Pines. There were a lot of people over there who contributed to us, the teachers. That was a big thing back then after, that was a big job to have, to be an educator mm-hmm. back in the day. So we had some of the best teachers that taught us. And, you know, they disciplined us. And you got disciplined by the teacher. You got disciplined again when you got home because the teacher had to correct
right.
you. You know, that old school, man. And
oh, trust me. I went to a Catholic school in Virginia Beach, Norfolk. And I remember Sister Catherine James. I remember Sister Roseanne Mary. And, like, you know. Yeah. They could be a little stern when it comes to the discipline, if you know what I mean.
Oh yeah,
but you learn that you learn about discipline and being accountable.
I remember Sister Superior; I could hear her footsteps walking down the hall.
we all have stories. We all have nightmares.
Nightmares, yes.
You mentioned the caddies. You mentioned Mr. McRae. I actually suggested to Mr. Pashley that the next statue behind the clubhouse. Of course, that's their decision, but I mean, I would love to see them recognize Mr. McRae and the contributions he made and that whole culture of the caddy, which has a huge, obviously, historical relevance to Pinehurst Resort and to everything that was built there over the 125 plus years.
Right.
You're an avid golfer. Talk about your game.
Oh, it's nowhere right now. About 3 or 4 years ago, after I came back about 9 years ago, take care of my parents. And as I was here, everybody was telling me, when are you going to open your father's place back up? The Cardinal Club in Pine Bluff, the Cardinal Park. So finally I decided, oh man, I got to open this place up. And it was in bad shape. It had been sitting dormant for about 17 years because my brothers and I, we were all around the country. My dad couldn't do it anymore and nobody was there to take over. But finally I decided, pine cone at a time, I'm picking them up, and I decided to open it back up. And it's just taking all my summers and what have you. In the fall, I decided I was going to start playing again. But, you know, I used to play. I played decent, not scratch golfer like you probably, but I played and had a good time. It's just being out there with the guys and the camaraderie. And growing up here, knowing the courses, you know, like Mid Pines and Pine Needles,
right.
the courses in Pinehurst, and knowing the people that work over there, and it's just wonderful to come to be out there amongst everybody and having a great time. And these are the best courses in the world. I can't wait to see number 10. I heard it's going to be a beast, like 2 and 4.
I've been lucky enough to play it.
And
I've walked it, and I'm just turned 62, and it was a grueling. It was a challenging walk.
Was it?
But it was beautiful. It's actually just a big boy rolling golf course. Beautiful views and elevation changes.
Wow.
If you remember the pit, they used some of the rounding for that.
Oh, good.
And, you know, so it's a beautiful golf course. Opens on April the 3rd, and there's already a lot of demand for it. So it's going to get a lot of press, and it's going to be an amazing golf course.
I can't wait. I'm excited. I used to play the pit all the time.
Yeah.
Nice track.
There's one hole. I believe it's the eighth hole. They used part of the quarry. It kind of reminds me a little bit of Tobacco Road.
Okay.
So when you play it, you actually have to hit over looks like a little mountain. That'd be your aiming point. But there's one hole at Tobacco Road where you don't see the green. It's surrounded, and it's the one by the highway.
Right.
That hole is just like that. You don't really see the green from your approach shot. But then, you know, it's interesting because then you go and play number 9, it's uphill par 4, and then you walk through it. And we played it wasn't marked,
mm-hmm.
so it doesn't tell you where the 10th hole is. You'd see the fairway behind it, which is 13. So a gentleman from Doak, Tom Doak's team, was there and said, hey, what do you think of the course? And we're like, where's the next hole? And it was back over to our right, almost back toward the fairway. But you come through this tree line, and it opens up, and you see this beautiful vista.
Wow.
And the par 5 10th hole goes down a ravine and back up the other side. That was the grueling part, going back up that ravine.
Right.
And then you come back the other way, 11, 12 is a par 4, or par 5, and then you play the rest and you go down by 17 where there's a nice pond par three, and then you finish. So it's a great routing. Tom Doak did a tremendous job, but if you get a chance to get out there, I highly recommend it. And if you want to visit, come and play it. It's going to be a great golf course.
Yes.
U.S. Open back here in June. Hadn't been back here in 10 years. We're going to have one every other 5 or 6 years through 2047, where, you know, pretty amazing times. You remember 1999. What was the U.S. Open like there? What are you anticipating this year?
Well, 1999 was amazing. My dad was on the President's Council, so we had total access of everything going on. We parked in the lot with the golfers and walked right in. And pardon me, I remember the last day I was praying that Payne Stewart would make that putt because we had come
back. Were you greenside?
I was greenside. I was the first one to give him a high five when he walked off the course.
Oh my gosh.
I go in the locker room. I'm holding his putter that just won the US
goodness.
Open. I'm taking a picture with his wife holding the trophy. I mean, it was crazy, man. You know, Tiger gave me his plaque off his locker. I mean, it was cool. So I had the booklet, of course, and I had people signing it because I was sitting up there with all the golf course designers, architects, and whatever. And I'm sitting up there having them sign my book, and every now and then I run across a player. So actually, I had a flag, and Payne signed my flag after the tournament. Payne Stewart signed it.
Huh.
And then just right after that is when he passed. But it was wonderful because we, you know, I was with my dad and my brothers, and we're sitting up there in high cotton and just enjoying
right,
it.
Yeah.
You know, every now and then I'd get out and walk around, and then I'd come back up there and sit up there because, you know, we had free food and free drinks, and we're just sitting there enjoying what used to be what's the Deuce now. That's where we were sitting up there watching it. And then the same thing when it came back in 2014. And actually, we played in a tournament. They had a pre-tournament for all the people who belonged to the President's Council. And my dad was on so he could bring my brothers and I in. And we actually played a tournament before the tournament on number two, which we won. We came in second place the next time. But, you know, it was just wonderful. We stayed at the hotel. Every time you came in, they had gifts for us. I'll tell you a funny thing. One night you pulled the ball when you went to dinner, and if the number was on there on the ball, you won a Scotty Cameron putter.
Uh-huh.
This is 99. Scotty Cameron was just coming. So I was like, man, I want one of them putters. They said they're going to give one away on a par three tomorrow closer to the pin. I pointed to it. I said, I'm going to win that sucker.
Yeah.
Hey, shot one, threw one in just like that. And I won. I still use that putter to this day.
Which par three was that?
I think it was number, I can't remember those holes. I think it was on the front side.
Yeah, it was number, I know number nine's a par three.
I think it was nine. I was starting to say that. Yeah, I think it was number nine. Yeah, so I won me a Scotty Cameron putter.
Wow. And you get a birdie on any of the par threes now. You get the coin. You get the number two coin.
Yeah,
It's pretty, you're sandbagging. You said your game's,
Oh, man, I tell you, I can't wait to get back in and start playing again, though.
Get out there, man. You gotta get out and play. Weather's getting warmer.
It is.
I'm getting the bug. So talk about playing. I mean, who would be your dream foursome if you had to pick three other people to play?
Oh, gosh. Well, I played with some pretty good folks back in the day. I used to play with Michael Jordan a few times. And I don't know, man.
Did you gamble with him?
Of course. Cut that. No. I won $10 from him. I tried to get him to sign.
Really?
He wouldn't sign. Yeah.
Oh, my man. He's. But you know how competitive he is. He wants to get that $10 back.
So
give me 10 cents.
So
he wants to get that back.
Let me show how competitive he is. So we played with my dad. We finished. My dad beat him. He's like, all right, let's go play 18 again, double the nut. My dad beat him. All right, let's drop a ball in the middle of the fairway, play in, double the nut.
My dad
beat
him. Goodness.
Okay, let's put a ball in the sand trap. Double the nut. I mean, all right, we went to the house. All right, let's shoot some pool. Double the nut. I mean, he just tried to get even. He couldn't stand it. My dad was beating the pants off of him.
That's
I played with Dean Smith a few times. The first time I played with Dean Smith, of course, you were gambling. You know, when I say press, I'm thinking I'm starting a new bet. You know, so I'm pressing. He's beating the pants out of me. Dean Smith was a good golfer, so I'm pressing every time I got two down. So at the last hole, I pressed and I beat him on the last hole. So I go to pay him. He said, "You don't owe me anything." I said, "How do I know anything, Coach? You beat me the pants off me over on the golf course." He said, "Every time you pressed, we were doubling the bet." I said, "I didn't know that." So I beat him the last hole. So he sent me one of his books he had written, and he said to Mitch Capel, somebody who played the last hole well.
Oh, wow. Great.
Yeah. So I don't know, man. I'd like to play with you. Shoot.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I don't know. And Michael Jordan, Dean Smith, and then Phil Wurz, you certainly declined in a big way adding me to that foursome.
I just like being out there and having fun with the guys and laughing and joking and
that's what it's all about.
It's all about, man.
Yeah, just go out and have fun.
Have fun, yeah.
I typically don't drink when I play, so I might have a beer now and then, but it's like I'm somewhat competitive, but and I don't bet a whole lot of money.
I don't either.
I just go out and enjoy the game.
That's me too, man. I don't like to bet a lot.
You know, you mentioned Cardinal Park, and we still have I think we bid for something. We still have an opportunity to go out there. We'll bring our team out there sometime soon. But talk about Cardinal Park. You mentioned a little bit. They're actually, I looked at the website, and it looks like there's some glamping opportunities out there.
Yes.
So what that's going to be debuting this summer, right?
Yes. We have glamping tents. I'm trying to get some tiny houses out there before the U.S. Open. I'm trying to get
it. Tiny houses are, they're blowing up.
Trying to get some RV setups out there for the U.S. Open.
Idea.
I get calls every day for that. Pardon me, but that place was set up. My dad bought that in 1962. He was trying to find a place for his salespeople to meet. Everything was segregated, and there was no places for his salespeople to meet. So he bought that, and then actually turned into a place where people wanted to come and have cookouts and things like that.
Yeah.
And so it turned into a recreation center, and a place where kids could safely go swimming, a place for people to go fishing. My dad liked to fish, so he had a place like that, and it just took off, and he did well with it. He had a little nightclub in there at one point. He'd bring big bands in there and that type of thing. So it's a great little spot. I'm looking at trying to get a 501c3 now because I'm not profitable. So
yeah.
I might as well take advantage of the 501c3. I got some folks working on that for me. And so we have family reunions that come in. I've got people now booking that had family reunions back in the day. We used to have what's his name from the Boston Celtics?
Sam Jones?
No, Johnson.
Dennis Jones, Johnson?
Sam Jones.
Sam Jones, yeah.
Sam Jones from the Boston Celtics. Mm-hmm. They used to have their family reunion the first weekend of August every year. You know, just good people coming down there having their family reunions and family fun. So we brought it back. I've had some things going on down there. We do Juneteenth down there now, and a lot of good things happening down there. So it's a historical place. It's a great spot. So there's a lot of history there.
You know, one thing we like to talk about here, since we advance tourism in Moore County, and you lived here and from here your entire life, the future of tourism. After the 2024 U.S. Open, I mean, there's going to be a dozen DOT projects. I mean, all the roads are going to be five-laned in and out of this area. Yeah. There's going to be so much growth. And you hear both sides. We hear it on our end. And I say, even if there wasn't tourism, there's still going to be growth here because of the industry that's happening north of us on 421. But talk about, we talked about having been raised here, grown up here. What about the future and growth and how do we get there? So by the time the 2029 U.S. Opens here, what kind of destination is this going to be, you think?
Oh, it's going to be a great destination. I mean, adding three more golf courses. We already had 38 golf courses in a 15-mile radius. Now you're going to have 41.
Very good. You know our promotional material.
I know it, man. I know it well. I'm always meeting people. They say, I'm from Southern Pines Pioneers area. Oh, my God. You guys have golf there? I say, we have 38 golf courses in a 15-mile radius.
Let me tell you about it.
So once we put in all that infrastructure, I mean, like I said, the housing is going up. People are building by leaps and bounds. And it's going to still be a fabulous place. I mean, there's a lot of industry coming in. There's a lot of job opportunities happening, which I like.
Yeah.
There's things happening with the museum at the Southern Pines Land Trust coming in. A lot of good things are happening in this town. And it's always, I think the people that are running the town, I think the government, the you guys, we're making sure that everything is done right. It's not going to be piecemealed and put together in a way that we're going to have issues down the road. So I'm pretty sure they've had the plans in place, the strategic plans, the 15-year, 20-year, 25-year plans, and they're implementing them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to happen, and I'm glad it's happening the way it's happening. I'm glad that things are going on.
And as is appropriate in Southern Pines, we hear the train. I know I can hear it in my headset. We're hearing the train, which is just a block away. This very symbolic of Southern Pines and the history and the heritage.
So let me tell you, when you're in Jonesboro, Tennessee, and you're on stage, if that train comes by, it's a good sign. But all the seasoned storytellers know to put that train in the story as it goes by.
Yeah, there you
and
go.
And here comes the train.
Speaking of stories, can you give us one more before we say goodbye?
Oh, let me think. Short story. There's one I always do pretty much when I leave, get ready to leave stage. If I'm visiting a town, let's say I'm in Southern Pines, I would say I've been here in Southern Pines for a day or two and say it's going to be hard as breaking oxen for to tear myself away. Folks always talking about their friendship and their hospitality. Well, they hadn't talked about it till they just been here to see. See just how you give me welcome to the best that's in the land. Feel the sort of grip you give me when you take me by the hand. He say, "We're glad to have you. Better stay a week or two, and the way you treat me, make me feel that every word is true. Feed me. Twill a hit of buttons cracking on my Sunday vest. Haul me round to see the wonders till I have to cry for rest. Drink to my health and pet and praise me till I start to feel as great as the sheriff of the county or the governor of the state. When I get home, my wife gonna think I'm crazy because I'm gonna go on so, and Nels, he gonna say, goodness gracious, granddaddy, can't you talk about nothing else? Well, play gone, and I'm just tickled. Being tickled ain't no sin. I've been here in Southern Pines, Pinehurst area. I ain't left yet, but I want to come again."
The incomparable Mitch Capel. Thanks so much.
Thanks, you, Phil.
Appreciate it.
Appreciate you, buddy.
Yeah, man, absolutely. We will tee it up sometime very soon before the U.S. Open, for sure. Again, Mitch will be performing at the Weymouth Center for the Arts and Humanities Sunday, February the 25th at 2 o'clock. Go to the Weymouth Center website. Tickets are free, but you want to get the tickets because they will be in high demand. One of the shows you said is sold out. Yeah. So, Mitch, thanks so much.
Thank you, Phil.
Appreciate it. If you want to learn more about tourism, go to our website, homeofgolf.com. If you want to watch our videos, go to our YouTube channel, which is Home of American Golf. And to watch this podcast and our series of podcasts, just Google and look for on your podcatcher, Paradise in the Pines. For Mitch Capel, I'm Phil Wirz. This has been Paradise in the Pines, and we'll see you next time.